China once ruled the world. For centuries, China dominated all of its neighbors politically, economically, and ideologically. Those days ended with the rise of European colonialism. But the ruling Chinese Communist Party wants to return it to its place of glory. To do this, it has to contend with its own people, its geography, and the existing US-led world structure. In this podcast, I would attempt to outline China, its problems, and the rationale behind its decisions that make the headlines. Ultimately, I hope to create a structure that you can use to place and contextualize any and all future actions by the Chinese state. China's a topic I'm very interested in, and an incredibly complicated one at that. My assessment of China is not the only one that exists in the world, and it's entirely possible I'm being too harsh in my criticism in some places and too generous with my praise in others. I would highly recommend that you do some of your own reading and research to reach your own conclusions on the nation. Finally, before we start, it is important for us to separate the actions of the state and the individuals living within the nation. Most people in the world do not get to choose where they live or the rules they live under. Any criticism in this podcast is criticism of the state and not of the people. Before we examine anything in depth, we first need a small bit of background on China. It is widely known it's a large country in the east of Asia and has a population of over 1.4 billion people. It is also widely considered the second strongest country in the world after America. Politically, it is best described as a bureaucratic authoritarian state. That is to say, there is no democracy. Ultimate power is also not invested in one dictator or a small group of people, as in Russia or North Korea, but power ultimately rests in the entirety of the ruling Chinese Communist Party, and large decisions must be made after discussion and debate with the entire of the elite of this group. China is also frighteningly totalitarian. The CCP have a level of control over people's lives almost unmatched anywhere in the world at present. The CCP have ruled China since 1949. It's their vision of Chinese greatness that has driven and shaped Chinese policy for the past decades. The first section of this podcast is going to be about the Chinese people and the laws that govern them. For the CCP to act upon its vision for Chinese ascendancy, they have to stay in control of China. And to stay in control, they have to have the support of the Chinese people. The job that is easier said than done, especially when your country has over 1.4 billion inhabitants, roughly 20% of the world's population. If even 5% of China began to riot against the government, that is 70 million people, more than the entire population of the UK, a number so unfathomably large that no nation could realistically deal with protests of this size. So the CCP devotes a large amount of time and a large amount of thought in how they can keep control of the population and ensure that these hypothetical riots do not become a reality. People are generally going to riot when they have no food, no job, and nowhere to live. If people are happy and content, if their lives are improving, they are unlikely to jeopardize the situation through protest. This is understood by the CCP. And a significant part of Chinese policy is therefore aimed at constantly improving the lives of its inhabitants and therefore hating the population. The Chinese government has been unbelievably successful at this. It's hard to overstate how impressive their economic policy has been. Between 1990 and 2015, over 600 million people in China escaped poverty. This is 50% of the total for the entire world in that same time period. I'll briefly explain how China achieved this economic miracle, and it's mostly through economic liberalization, through increasing their trade and marketing themselves as a factory of the world. This led to massive investment for other countries and employment growth, the growth in cities, the growth of ports, and the growth of factories. The government has also looked to the future and provided a world-class education system, meaning high productivity and increasing the numbers of highly skilled, well-paying jobs. The Chinese economy is also supported by the state promotion of Chinese-owned companies in many of sectors, ranging from telecoms to automobiles, with the aim of competing with foreign firms, increasing domestic innovation, and reducing the reliance on foreign companies and markets for employment. The people of China have seen these benefits, these material benefits. Their parents or their grandparents could have been subsistence farmers, and now they're living in an apartment in the city with air conditioning and internet connection and a large screen TV. This is one of the reasons why China's remained so stable and have been relatively few anti-government protests or large-scale anti-government movements. People are unwilling to jeopardize the growth and the wealth the Communist Party have proven they can give to the people of China. One of the most famous and controversial pieces of Chinese legislation is the one-child policy. When considering the problems faced by the CCP, it becomes easy to find the justification for its implementation. Firstly, a decrease in fertility means there are less people the state has to oversee and provide for in the first place. The Chinese government was well aware that just 2 decades earlier, 30 million people had died in a famine, and food shortages were still an ever-present threat to the Chinese state. It also ensures that children receive a better standard of education, as more resources are available for each child. A better educated and more productive workforce is good for the Chinese economy. Finally, a smaller cohort means that the supply of labour is lower, meaning unemployment is lower and wages have increased, providing the people with an improved standard of living. The relaxation of the policy in 2015 was not motivated by humanity, compassion, or weakening of the state, but the realisation that there soon would not be enough workers to support the increasingly ageing population. The one-child policy is interesting, because primarily it's a policy around population control, but it's also intrinsically linked with the ability for China to continue to control its population. The CCP realises that material benefits alone cannot keep a population happy permanently. There will always be dissent against its authoritarian and totalitarian rule. People will always want democracy, and these people eventually will start a movement to an attempt to gain these things. The CCP knows this, so it also maintains control through less benevolent methods, such as the control of free speech and the looming threat of repercussions for any anti-government action. Free speech essentially does not exist in China. It has the least free internet in the world. All media is state-owned, so the news and the discourse largely follows the party line. This helps limit the spread of any ideas which run counter to government thought. The state also engages in a national form of gaslighting by twisting the meanings and concepts of words to almost their polar opposite. For example, democracy as a concept has been twisted by the Chinese state to the point where the majority of people in China do not think it refers to the ability to vote or choose their leadership. This means that groups pushing for more freedom or democracy have to do so against an ingrained education system that has pushed the opposite message for decades. The CCP is not just subtly controlling narratives and messaging through information, but there are incredibly harsh punishments for anyone the state sees as acting against its best interests. A recent example of this is the introduction of a social credit system and the mass surveillance system that goes alongside it, where positive and negative scores are assigned to actions, and if you accrue too many D-marks, you can face the denial of free movement and other repercussions. The threat to free movement alone is enough to deter the majority of people from undertaking any actions that could be seen to run counter to the Communist Party. But it's far from the worst possibility that could happen to someone the state views as one of their opponents. The Communist Party is ruthless when dealing with those it sees as its enemies. The best way to understand the relationship between the CCP and the Chinese people is that of a great bargain, the social contract writ large. Beijing massively improves the quality of life for the people, and in return, the people agree to tolerate the state surveillance and totalitarian laws. It's a delicate and ongoing balance that requires the Chinese state to continually provide massive economic growth to its people, continually provide increased services and material benefits, and it determines much of the policy making that has taken place in China in the last half of a century. The second major factor shaping Chinese decision-making is its geography. As well as having an astronomical population, China is so huge and geographically diverse. The sheer size of the nation has shaped its bureaucracy and governance for millennia and continues to do so today. How Beijing maintains control of its borders and all the regions within it is very important to understanding Chinese decisions, especially on a geopolitical level. For a simple geographical lesson, it is easiest to think of China as a rectangle, with Siberian tundra and steppe to the north, the Gobi Desert to the northwest, the Himalayas to the west and southwest, and the monsoon, almost jungle regions of Thailand and Vietnam to its southeast. The eastern edge of China was taken up by coastline. The vast majority of people in China live on the coast to the east and southeast of the country. with the minority ethnic groups such as Tibetans and Uyghur Muslims tending to live more on the edges of the nation. The distribution of people and the extreme in borders has led to China having two major geography problems. China's first geography problem has to do with cohesion. It is important to understand that the vast majority, over 90% of people living in China, are in the Han ethnic group. This ethnicity dominates economically and politically, and has done so for thousands of years. This group also makes up the vast, vast majority of people living on the coast and on the southeast, in the major manufacturing cities. Generally, but not exclusively, as you move away from the densely populated coast, the amount of non-Han people in each region increases and increases until you get to the border regions of China, Tibet, Xinjiang, and Inner Mongolia, where the majority of people are no longer Han Chinese, but are part of various minority groups within the country. For years, many of these groups have called for autonomy or even independence from China, and Beijing sees these people and these groups as a threat to the cohesion and unity of the country, and has attempted throughout the decades to Sinicize them, strip them of their uniqueness and values, and bring them in line with mainland China. We have seen this on a large scale recently, with the treatment of the Uyghur Muslim population in the northwest region of the country, Xinjiang. This group has been seen as a danger to the very integrity of China. There's massive sentiment towards independence among the native population of the region, and that is something that China cannot accept. The Uyghur province, 17% of the country, had acted as a large buffer region between the interior of the nation and any hostile force coming in from the west. There's also a wealth of mineral riches as well as oil and gas in the region that Beijing refuses to give up any level of control over. So any independence movement is seen as a direct threat to the power and ability of China to operate. How does the CCP go about securing their territorial integrity? The first step is by increasing links between the periphery of the nation and the Han coast. This goes back to money and investment. As mentioned earlier, wealth keeps people content and quiet. Huge infrastructure investments into these regions link different populations and allow for communications and the movement of goods and services. Because of this, certain groups have become far wealthier than they were, and therefore more amenable to rule from Beijing. However, it is also true that the minority regions benefited far less economically than the Han coast under the CCP. Furthermore, the biggest reason for these things is to allow access for Han firms and Han workers. This is a process called Sinicization, and essentially boils down to Beijing encouraging Han firms to move into these regions, bringing with them huge amounts of Han workers whose existences in these areas are subsidized, literally swamping the native population with Han coastal dwellers who bear no sentiment towards independence and are culturally distinct from the original inhabitants of the region. Whilst exact numbers are hard to find, it is not unlikely that the majority of people in the Uyghur province of Xinjiang are not independence-minded Uyghur, but pro-Beijing Han. We have also recently seen the overt cultural genocide that has taken place in Xinjiang. The current course of action being taken by the CCP is the most aggressive policy of bringing about cultural homogeneity in recent times. However, it is a continuation of a process that has been going on for decades. If you are unaware, currently millions of Uyghurs are currently undergoing a process where they're sent to re-education camps, often with appalling conditions, where their cultural and religious values are being stripped away. As mentioned before, Beijing hopes to remove the threat of separatism in one of their distant provinces and ensure the security of their borders and strategic depth, and they believe they can achieve this by rewriting the cultural values that hold the group together in one of these regions. This exact scenario has been repeated across China in different areas for years, although often less aggressively, with the most famous other example being Tibet, which, like Xinjiang, has had a massive amount of investment in it to link it to the rest of the country, as well as a huge influx of Han migrants to dilute any separatist sentiment. Like the Uyghurs, Tibetans have also faced laws attempting to remove their culture and religion, and, like Xinjiang, China cannot have an independent Tibet. Tibet is the Himalayas, which directly overlooks the fertile center of China. Currently, they act as an essentially impenetrable barrier against India, one of China's biggest regional rivals. More importantly, however, is Tibet's most valuable resource, water. The vast majority of fresh water in China originates in Tibet. Waters from Tibet also water India, Bangladesh, and other nations in the region. China cannot give this resource up, and they will take almost any action to protect their control over the area. This also goes to explain why there are so many border skirmishes between China and India in the Himalayas. China believes it cannot give any quarter in this region, and so it does not. From those examples, it's easy to draw a conclusion that China is afraid of non-conformity in any of its regions. Hong Kong is another famous and relevant example of this. Whilst it is vastly different to the other areas we've discussed, as it's essentially a city, it's still not conforming to the standard Chinese practices and the standard Chinese ideals the CCP wants. This is not due to cultural desires or nationalistic desires in Tibet or Xinjiang, due to an ideological split, the desire for democracy and freedom from the totalitarian policies on the mainland. Like Tibet and like Xinjiang, Beijing is not content to let these differences settle and spread and potentially turn into a movement, so it's beginning to crack down and increase the amount of control they have over Hong Kong. This explains why there have been so many protests, so many new laws introduced in the area by China. It's an attempt to curb democratic sentiment and the growing restlessness at Chinese rule in the area. The second geographic problem that affects China is its supply chains. As mentioned at the start of the section, China is largely surrounded by difficult terrain or the ocean. Like most nations, China is not self-sufficient. Despite massive efforts from the government, the nation cannot supply all the food it needs, and potentially even more importantly, it cannot supply anywhere near as much energy as it requires. 70% of the nation's oil and 50% of its gas is imported. The factories and cities cannot run without imports, and the Chinese economy very quickly collapsed. These imports even slowed down ever so slightly. Were a major war to break out, China could worry about food and fuel getting into the country. So lots of their foreign policy is defined around ensuring their supply can continue and continue to come to the nation under any circumstance. China can import fuel overland or overseas. Overland is difficult. As previously mentioned, lots of the Chinese periphery is in pretty extreme geography. Lots of it is incredibly empty. However, China still manages to import huge amounts of natural gas from Russian pipelines. Essentially, it's their only major overland option for fuel imports. China's reliance on Russian fuel goes a long way to explaining their reasonably warm political relationship. Beijing does not want to jeopardize its Russian gas, so it tends to agree with Moscow on the world stage. Clearly, not all fuel can come from Russian pipes, however. China's far too big of a country. It would drain the Russian gas fields instantly if all of the fuel they needed came from there. So a large amount must be imported from overseas into China's ports. The sea is incredibly interesting for China. Whilst it has a huge coastline, it is still essentially boxed in. To its east, it has South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, the Philippines, Malaysia, and Singapore, essentially completely encircling its coast and creating an incredible number of small bottlenecks between the various countries that could ensure a naval blockade of China could happen with relative ease. These countries matter, as all are either close allies or extremely close allies with the United States, China's principal rival on the world stage. This essentially gives the US the ability to end Chinese imports overseas. Obviously, this is something that China cannot allow to continue, and is something that China is actively working to end. They're doing this through massively increasing the size of their navy, with the eventual aim of being able to rival the US Blue Water Navy by 2050. This would allow China the option to brute force the oceans open and keep imports coming in and exports moving out. In a similar vein, the South China Sea is a famous issue of contention with China and many of their neighbours. It's an area where many nations claim a series of islands to the south of China, and China has taken these islands, occupied them and started to militarize them to allow China to put naval pressure into the region. Finally, China started taking a plan to weaken US influence all around the world, but specifically with their neighbors. But I will talk more of that in the next section. The CCP feels as though it requires all of China to fall in line, to have similar political ideas, to have similar cultural values. And unfortunately for them, China's just too big, too varied geographically for this to happen. This leads to massive problems as different regions have different opinions, different values, different ideas on how a country should be run. Not only that, despite China's massive size, it's still boxed in, it's still surrounded by potential enemies or hostile terrain. And China as a country relies more on trade, more on importing and exporting food and fuel and goods and services than almost any country in the world. China cannot supply itself. It is not a one-nation island. It is not a one-nation world. It has to rely on other countries for food and fuel to keep the lights on and to keep the factories ticking over. If these go out, then the CCP loses its legitimacy as the economic benefactors of the country, the people who bring about peace and security. If they cannot provide electricity, if they can't provide food for the people because of the geographical reasons I explained, then they'll face massive problems going forward. Finally, the last major factor that influences the decisions that China makes is their desire to once again move back to the center of the world. At the start of this podcast, I mentioned the vision the CCP has for the country, recreating a historical, geopolitical setting where for centuries China was the center of the world. Return to a golden age of China under the Han, under the Tang dynasty, where all nations paid tribute and looked towards Beijing for spiritual, ideological, economic leadership. It's hard to overstate how important this goal is for the people in charge of China. The party stakes a large amount of its right to rule and its legitimacy on the promise of returning China to greatness. Most of their international relations is therefore set around bringing this vision forward, bringing back this idea of unparalleled global preeminence. To do this, China's facing an uphill battle. Since the start of the Second World War, essentially, or since the end of the Second World War even, the United States has dictated the world order and has entrenched their power globally over the last almost a century. China has to flex their economic and military muscle in order to push this ambition forward. And the biggest obstacle standing in the way is the entrenched global liberal world order that all countries are party to. All countries, no matter how autocratic, no matter how strong their dictators, have to at least pay lip service to the notion of democracy and to the notion of freedom and human rights. The worst dictators will still have an election. North Korea still has elections. And although Kim Jong-un wins 99.97% of them, there's still the action, the pretense that democracy exists. This is a system headed and maintained by the US, who subsequently have an ideological influence on global politics. Due to this, China has the need to prove its form of bureaucratic authoritarianism is ideologically superior to the one espoused by the West and by the United States. This links back to Chinese economic performance. There's no better way of showing their ideological superiority than by showing their economic superiority. The Chinese system successfully manages the largest country in the world and is constantly improving the quality of life of the people in a safe and secure way as long as they agree to and adhere to the rules imposed by the Chinese government. It is easy to see how this can appear as an attractive form of government for nations to borrow ideas from, to borrow concepts from. Why no data from China regarding economics, crime, or really any social statistics should ever fully be trusted? It is part of the Chinese prerogative to export their system, and unflattering numbers will not aid that. Whilst numbers showing 15 years of incredibly high GDP growth make the country, make the politics, and make the system far more attractive. Another good example of Chinese attempting to sell their system was the Beijing Olympics, the most watched event on TV in human history. Half the world watched part of the Beijing Olympics, and it was a spectacle of Chinese opulence, efficiency, wealth, and power. It was a message to the world saying, "We are here, we are strong, look at us." It was a statement about Chinese ambition. Modern attempts of China to sell its system globally also come at a time when democracy around the world is largely considered to be under threat. with many countries aggressing the ideals of the free press or fair elections. Poland, Hungary, Turkey, just in Europe alone, show that democracy is not as strong and as inevitable and as unending as was once thought after the Cold War ended. In fact, almost all Western nations, public trust in democracy has been faltering and decreasing. With many people in many countries moving away from liberal democratic ideas, China sees now as the perfect time to move and to push its system as the alternative that people have been looking for. Investment buys friendship, trade cements alliances, and understanding can be gained through aid deals. On a global stage, China parts with her money far, far more readily with countries that seem as more amenable to its ideal world order, a China-centric world order, to the exclusion of the US. Economically, Chinese investment ranges from fairly benign foreign direct investment, which buys friendship, all the way to, so-called by many Western scholars, debt-trap diplomacy and neocolonialism. Neocolonialism is an often overlooked aspect of Chinese foreign policy, and it revolves around China lending significant amounts of money and credit in order to fund vital infrastructure projects in impoverished and often corrupt regimes in Africa and Asia. In return, the CCP gains access to a nation's mineral wealth, as well as its friendship on the international stage. China knows full well that these countries are almost certainly unable to pay the loans back, and counts on the permanent indebtedness of these countries to Beijing as a form of leverage over the entire nation to bring it in line with China on a global level. This is especially compelling if you consider the implicit power China can hold over a country if it controls a large stake of a nation's infrastructure or power generation. The state-backed Chinese firms in Africa that employ a million Chinese citizens could potentially bring multiple nations to a standstill if they were ordered to switch off the power. On the economically more benign scale is Chinese attempts to buy favour with nations by offering lucrative trading deals and investment opportunities. This is best shown through the Belt and Road Initiative, an absolutely monumental multinational deal that stretches from Italy to Southern Africa and the Pacific. At its core, it's an attempt to increase trading and economic ties around the world, between China and the rest of the world, especially to the expense of the United States. Generally, nations benefiting from Chinese patronage are much, much more hesitant to criticize or condemn Chinese actions from fear that the money tap would be switched off. We can see this in the global response to the Chinese atrocities against the Uyghur people. Generally, nations that are wealthy enough to avoid Chinese economic coercion have been far harsher in their criticism of the Chinese treatment of the Uyghur people compared to poor nations who often have massive economic ties and rely on Chinese patronage for their economic growth, who have in many cases supported and praised the Chinese actions in Xinjiang. China needs to buy all these favors around the world. Its rapid militarization, its aggressive actions in Tibet and Xinjiang, its occupation and militarization of the South China Sea do not make its neighbors happy, do not reassure other countries of its intent. The money offered by China to many of their neighbors is definitely a soothing balm to abate much of the criticism that they would otherwise face. As mentioned earlier, China is currently building up a navy that they hope will one day match the US in terms of strength, a navy capable of allowing China to have a military presence at all points in the world at any moment, something that currently only the US can really claim to be able to do. The Chinese army is also massive and growing in size, around 2.5 million people in operation, and it's modernizing incredibly quickly. It wants to offer itself as not just an economic alternative or an ideological alternative to the US, but a military alternative. One that can build an alliance chain equal in strength or size to NATO or any of the other alliances that the US have built up over the last 70 years. So now it's time for conclusion. China has the future planned out. By 2049, the CCP will have led China for 100 years, and by that date, aims to equal or eclipse the US in terms of global relevance. The CCP knows how to stay in power. how to keep the people on their side, or keep them too scared to speak out. They have taken and continue to take violent action against regions that don't conform to their vision, while suppressing any narratives that speak against them. They are also securing their material and territorial integrity through the management of their supply chains and the strengthening of their military. If you are to ask me if I believe that China will be as strong, stronger than the US in 30 years' time, I wouldn't know how to answer. Too much is left to be unknown. And whilst I haven't really discussed in this podcast, China still faces a large number of difficulties that they must overcome before they realise this ambition. However, without doubt, it is true to say that there's not been a rivalry in the global order in this scale since the collapse of the USSR in the 1990s. Understanding the goal of the CCP to bring China to the center of the world is the key to understanding China as a whole and understanding its actions. And that is the most important thing that should be taken from this podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. I certainly had an interesting time writing and recording it. This was an episode I promised the group I'd make for about a year, and I kept rewriting or procrastinating it away, putting it behind other projects. But I finally finished it, and you can finally hear it. Before I sign out, I highly recommend that you check out the other podcasts we've made if you haven't already, as well as checking out our YouTube channel, where Theo is currently making some incredible videos on some of the most interesting British Prime Ministers. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Thanks for listening.